compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, welcome back. This is hour two of the program. The number is 888-994-9149. Give me a call. We'll be happy to get you on the air. Let's go to Marilyn now, listening in Coventry, Rhode Island. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Patrick. Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning.
My question is, how do I respond to someone who says that the Catholic Church spends way too much money on their churches, their cathedrals, their basilicas, and even the supposed treasures that are supposed to be in the Vatican? How do I respond to that?
Well, there are a few things you can say. One question you might ask is, you know, how much money do you think the church spends? Just ask the question. And then they'll probably have an answer. You know, they'll probably say, well, I bet it's a lot. Okay, maybe it's a lot. But what is a lot? How do you define that? So I would start by turning the question around, or turning the challenge around, and begin asking questions. So that would be one of my first questions. Well, what do you mean by a lot? How much is a lot? See what they say. Then, once you have an answer, you know, on that issue, then you could say something like, okay, well, what about, do you spend money on your home? Do you have some nice things? Do you have some nice things for you? And they'll say, well, yeah, but that's different because I'm a private person. And I'm, you know, of course I have some nice things, but this is the church after all. And then you can point out, well, it's interesting you say that because the church, you know, doesn't have these nice things for itself. It has these nice things, first of all, for God and the glory of God, but also for the benefit of the people. So let's take the Vatican Museum as an example. The Vatican Museum is filled with precious artifacts from many different eras. And, you know, we all know that if the Vatican were to say, okay, well, let's take this famous statue, I don't know, pick one of the famous statues by Michelangelo or something, and they throw that on eBay, and the next thing you know, that's parked in the living room of some Arabian sheik who purchased it for himself, and the rest of the world will never see it again. So these artifacts that have great value, they're really invaluable insofar as, you know, we can't put a price tag on it because it's part of the patrimony of humanity. And everybody can come and benefit from it. You can see it. You can, in some cases, touch these things. And if we were to sell them, you make some money. Okay, great. We give that to the poor. And 6 months or a year later, there are still poor people. And that beautiful object that belongs to all human beings is no longer there. I mean, those are some of the considerations that we would have to take into account, you know. Okay. So the church is not holding on to these things for the purpose of amassing money. I mean, because there's no way to really put a value on those things, I think, anyway. You know, and the other thing, too, is we would have to say to the person who's talking about this, well, what about all the vast monies that are spent by the church on a daily basis in feeding the hungry and clothing the naked and the free medical care and the homes for unwed mothers and the orphanages. And it just goes on and on and on. This is all over the world, mind you. And it's the Catholic Church doing this at the local level, as it has been since time immemorial. You can ask the person, do you take those things into account and see what they say? You see what I'm suggesting here is that you don't go on the defensive.
Well, I get your point.
Yeah, so in other words, you don't go on the defensive and start backpedaling. You turn it around, and you put the burden of proof on the shoulders of the person who's making the claim and start asking questions like this, and I think it can be a much more fruitful kind of discussion.
Okay, I appreciate that. I do get the point now, and thank you so much, Patrick, and thanks for everything you do.
Oh, you're most welcome. Thanks. This is just a little tidbit here, but yeah, this is an important topic to talk about. I actually have a chapter on this very issue in a book that I wrote called Answer Me This, and it's a book that deals with very common kinds of challenges that the Catholic Church faces, this being one of them, You know, you can ask the other person, well, you know, do you, I mean, what are you doing personally? How much money are you spending personally on helping other people? It would be something that we should all ask ourselves. It's easy to spend other people's money. You know, it's easy to point fingers and say, well, so-and-so or this person is not doing enough. When in fact, you probably don't have any real idea how much that person may be doing. So it's easy to become indignant about what other people are doing or not doing. But a lot of people are a lot more forgiving when it comes to their own, you know, willingness or unwillingness to do the things that are difficult to help other people. And, you know, it reminds me of a story since we were talking a few minutes ago about the late, great Archbishop Fulton Sheen. There's a story that he told, and the general outline of the story is that he was speaking at a parish somewhere, and they had him to the rectory for dinner. It was a big deal, of course, because it's Archbishop Sheen. And at the dinner table, one of the young priests at this parish was giving Archbishop Sheen a hard time about why are you, you know, why does the church have so much money? How come the church has all these fancy buildings, investments, and what about the poor and all of that? And Archbishop Sheen just gave him the standard answer, you know, this is for the glory of God. It doesn't belong to me or it doesn't belong to the priest. This is for all people. And let's not forget all the hardworking folk over the centuries, in some cases, who with their blood, sweat, and tears and their money, they paid for these churches. They wanted these churches to be built beautiful and for the glory of God, as opposed to a shack or a meeting hall kind of thing. And this young priest just kept haranguing him. And so eventually, as he tells the story, he took the priest aside and he said, Father, he looked him in the eye. He said, Father, how long have you been stealing from the collection basket? And the priest just sort of unraveled and admitted under scrutiny that, in fact, he had been doing that. And I don't know if Archbishop Sheen was clairvoyant, probably not clairvoyant, but he was certainly a student of humanity. He could understand people and he could read people pretty well. And he picked up that all of this tub thumping from the young priest about the church's wealth and the church has too much money and all that, it was an indication that he was trying to justify his own theft from the collection basket. And you know, that story has always stuck with me because it plays into all kinds of other areas. And this is something that you can keep in mind when you're talking to somebody who's challenging you or the Catholic Church. Just remember that although it's not necessarily the case, it's entirely possible that that's actually a smokescreen for something deeper that's going on. Or somebody who's angry at the church and it is constantly taking pot shots at the church. I've met people like this. I've known people like this. Chances are you have too. And one of the sad realities of human nature is we sometimes find ourselves lashing out because we're trying to cover up something in ourselves. And so be aware that when your coworker or your brother-in-law or somebody is giving you a hard time about X, Y, or Z, there may be a deeper reason involved. Let me tell you a story about that. I was speaking in Florida. And I was at a big conference, so multiple speakers, and I had given my talk, and I was back at my book table signing books and meeting people and such. And I noticed out of the corner of my eye, there was this woman, younger woman, probably mid-30s maybe, and she was sort of scowling at me. She stood about 10 or 15 feet off to my left, and every so often as I'm signing books and saying hello to people, I kind of glance up and she'd still be there and she was kind of scowling at me. And I realized she was waiting to talk to me. She was waiting until the last person left, but she did not look happy. So when the time came, I smiled at her and I said, hello. And her response to me was, don't even try it. What? I said, hello. What do you mean, don't even try it? She says, I know what you do. She says, I know that you're all about trying to get people to become Catholic. She said, well, I'm an ex-Catholic. And I hate the Catholic Church. And there's no way I would ever go back to the Catholic Church. And I'm thinking to myself, well, why are you even here then? And she anticipated that question. She says, I'm only here because my husband, who's a Catholic, he dragged me here. And I don't want to be here. And, you know, I've had it up to here with the Catholic Church. So as she's saying this, and I'm thinking, why is she like singling me out? What is what's the reason for this conversation? But I noticed I was starting to get angry. It doesn't take much, right? Sometimes you just get in a zone where you just easily get angry. So her pushy, sarcastic, insulting things that she was saying, it was, you know, starting to get steamed. So I said, you said you're an ex-Catholic. What happened? And she said, well, do you really want to know? I said, yeah, sure. So she's telling me, you know, you worship statues and you worship Mary and you think that that wafer is really Jesus and it's not, it's just a piece of bread and you think you can earn your salvation. And I mean, these are things I've heard a million and one times before over the years. And that too, quite frankly, was starting to get me a little bit irritated. So I'm just waiting at this point now for this woman to stop talking so that I could do a Mexican hat dance on all of her arguments. I was waiting for her to be quiet so that I could refute her. And in that moment, I kid you not, I had this, I don't know what to call it, an intuition, a still small voice. I mean, I don't believe it was God speaking to me. Could have been my guardian angel. But I just, in the moment, I perceived this intuition to just zip it. Just be quiet. Don't respond. Don't say anything. And I'm thinking, but where did that come from? Because that's not my modus operandi. That's not how I typically would operate. So I thought, okay, I'll follow that intuition. And when she was done giving me her diatribe against the Catholic Church, I just didn't say anything. I just sort of stood there. And for a moment, I thought, oh, boy, she thinks I don't have an answer, which was a blow to my pride, which could deserve, my pride certainly deserves many blows. And that was a blow that it took because I was thinking, well, she's going to think I don't have an answer. And I just kept quiet, much against my own desire to speak up on this issue. So she kind of looked at me like, well, aren't you going to say something? And I said, well, you know, you used to be Catholic? And she said, yeah. I said, well, what happened? I said it again, basically, what happened? And she kind of got less angry. And maybe a little bit of the wind came out of her sails now that she got out all of the complaints that she had about the Catholic Church. So she said, well, you really want to know? I said, yeah. We went and sat down at some tables nearby. This was an indoor, kind of a large convention center setting. So it was a place where you could eat lunch and such. And there was nobody really around there for 20, 30 feet away. So we went and sat down at this table. And she put her purse down on the table. She sat across on one side. I sat on the other. And she says, well, here's what happened. She said, I was raised in a very devout Catholic family. And my mom and dad were strict Catholics. She said that a couple of times, that her family was strict in their Catholicism. She said, we went to Mass every Sunday. We prayed the rosary. I went to Catholic grammar school, Catholic high school. And what my parents didn't know, she said, was when I was about 18 years old, I was fooling around with my boyfriend, and I got pregnant. And she paused. She sort of took a deep breath, and she said, and when I found out I was pregnant, I was really terrified because my boyfriend was trying to get me to have an abortion, and my parents, of course, would have flipped out at even the suggestion of that. And so I knew that I couldn't tell them that I was expecting a baby because they would disown me. They would be so ashamed. You know, their super duper Catholic daughter got herself in trouble. That would bring shame to the family. So she says, I couldn't tell my parents. I couldn't tell my brothers and sisters because they would tell my parents. My boyfriend's trying to get me to have an abortion. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to turn. And it was getting urgent because she said she would start showing soon and she's going to have to do something. So she told me that she went to a Catholic parish a couple towns over where nobody knew her. And without an appointment or anything, she showed up at the parish office and she asked to see the priest. The boyfriend's waiting in the car out at the curb. She's nervous and, you know, an emotional wreck, and she's scared, and she asks to see the priest. And the priest kind of pops out of his office for a minute. Yeah, what's up? What's up? And so she told him. She says, "I'm single. I'm pregnant. I don't know what to do. I'm not sure what to do, and I need some help." And the priest's reaction, she told me, was, "Well, you know, these pregnancy tests are often inaccurate. No big deal. Take it again next week. It's probably nothing. And listen, I don't have time. I got stuff I got to do. So he shooed her out of the office and didn't help her, didn't pray with her, didn't refer her, didn't do anything except to let her know that her problem wasn't important to him because he had other stuff that he had to do. So now, as she's telling me this story, she's starting to cry. I'm saying nothing. I'm just sitting there saying nothing, just listening. And she's starting to cry. And she says the only thing she could do at that point was she got in the car and her boyfriend drove her down to the abortion clinic and paid the $300 and she had an abortion. Now at this point, this poor woman who was berating me so furiously 10 minutes earlier, now her head was down on this lunch table and she was sobbing. She couldn't even talk anymore. She was sobbing and her shoulders were heaving. And I think she was trying not to just completely fall apart. And I can imagine she was embarrassed in front of a total stranger, me. So it seemed like at least a minute before she could begin speaking again. She was so overcome with pain. And when she started speaking again, her head was still somewhat lowered, and speaking through her tears, she said, and that's when I began to hate the Catholic Church. She said, because I knew my parents wouldn't help me. They would disown me. That priest didn't help me. And she said, I had no choice but to abort my baby. That's how she felt. She said, I had no choice. I had to abort my baby. And I was so angry and so hurt and so much in pain. And she said, there were some friends of mine who suggested that she go with them to their church. And she said, okay, I will. And she started going to their church. She just turned her back on the Catholic Church. And she said, and that priest, she said it several times, she said, that priest, he didn't help me. And what I perceived as I was listening to her story was that the priest personified for her the Catholic Church. He, in his unwillingness to help her, he personified in her mind this Catholic Church that she had been raised with. And so she entered into, by her own explanation, she entered into a time of great hatred of the Catholic Church. And she left with a vengeance and was very anti-Catholic. Now, fast forward, you know, all these years to when she's now talking with me. So that might have been, you know, 18, 20 years had gone by. And so as she's saying all this and she's drying her tears and kind of getting her composure back, and I'm sure she was embarrassed. And what did I do? I blurted out the first thing that came to my mind. I said, well, you need to go to confession. And she looked at me as if I had said, here, hold this rattlesnake. She looked at me with a look of contempt and disgust, and she said it. She says, what do you mean go to confession? Didn't you listen to anything I said? I hate the Catholic Church. I would never go back to the Catholic Church. She was shouting again. And she got her purse, she stood up, and she didn't say thanks for nothing, but the look on her face did. And she got up and she walked away. And I was kicking myself. Why did I say that? Of all the things I could have said, why did I say that? Why couldn't I have been more pastoral? Why couldn't I have been more anything but that? Why did I say that? I was very unhappy with myself. And I thought, okay, well, I'm going to try to put that out of my mind because it was so disappointing to me. And she walked away and that was it. Well, about 6 weeks went by and I got an email from her. Out of the blue, she looked me up. And her opening sentence in this email was, dear Patrick, you were right. I needed to go to confession. I was flabbergasted. I was jaw on the floor. And so I read her email, and the essence of the email was, when you said that to me after I had shared this deep, dark secret and all the pain that went with it, and when you said that I need to go to confession, I was so angry and so offended that you would say that. But she said, I was so angry and so offended, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And the more I thought about it, the more angry I got, and the more angry I got, the more I thought about it. And she said, eventually, she said it got to the point where she thought to herself, maybe this is God telling me I need to come back to the sacrament of confession. But no, that can't be. And she said, finally, she said to the Lord, I mean, if this is really you telling me to do this, I'll do it, but I won't like it. But I'll do it, but I won't like it. But I'll do it. And she did it. She described in her email and a subsequent one about how she went to another Catholic parish and she made a good sacramental confession. She got everything out, including the abortion and everything that went with it. And she said the priest in this case was very wise and he was patient and he was exactly the person she needed in that moment to help her through that situation. And you know what happened? She came back to the practice of her faith. And I thought I had said the stupidest thing in the world. And in retrospect, I look back on it and it wasn't me speaking. I think it was the Lord speaking through this dumb ox, you know, through this Balaam's donkey. And he was able to give her the words that she needed to hear in the moment. And it was exactly what she needed to be able to start healing that wound and come back to the practice of her faith. So all of the rigmarole up front, all of the, well, you worship Mary, and the Catholic Church is trying to earn its salvation, all this other stuff, it had nothing to do with the real problem. None of those things were the real problem. And if I hadn't listened, this is my final point, we got to take a break. If I hadn't listened to that intuition in the moment, maybe my guardian angel, I do not know. But if I had ignored that, and if I had started blabbering, and picked up my Bible and started doing my Mexican hat dance on her arguments, you know what would have happened? None of the rest of it. Because we never would have sat down. She never would have revealed this issue. The blow up wouldn't have happened and everything else that took place after that. None of that would have happened. So the only thing that I look back on it and say, man, I'm glad I did that, was I bit my lip and didn't say anything. Let's take a break. I'll be right back. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
All right, let's get this road show back on the road. Let's go to Denise in St. John, Indiana. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Patrick. How are you?
I am well, thank you. Thanks for calling.
Good, good. I'm new to Relevant Radio. Love it. I'm a cradle Catholic. From kindergarten to university. So this is just a comment I try to keep respectful. Mm-hmm. But when people ask me, well, I don't know how you can be Catholic and see all these churches. Now, I did have the great privilege of going to Rome with my parents all over Italy because we are all Italian. And my father's first cousin was Monsignor at Santa Maria Maggiore Church, which is one of the basilicas in Rome. Mm-hmm. And he explained to me, as he's showing me gorgeous vestments done by nuns, and I'm just incredible treasures. In fact, the roof at Santa Maria Maggiore is the first gold that Columbus brought back to Ferdinand and Isabella, the king and queen, and he did actually, whatever the artisan was, it is 22 karat gold all over this wooden ceiling. Lots of riches. I don't know that you can put a price on it, like you said, with Michelangelo statues and so on. However, I say to people, okay, with due respect, I watch just, you know, out of curiosity, maybe a mega church or, you know, a person who's on TV who we know basically have private jets and have mega mansions. And respectfully, I say to this person, well, do they have orphanages? I know of one person, I won't mention his name, who did not allow people during a hurricane to take shelter in his mega church because he was afraid of the carpeting being ruined. On the other hand, my cousin, the priest, you know, he was the head of this church in Rome. My father said, watch him. So he was explaining the history, blah, blah, blah. And a very filthy, you know, beggar type of man came in. And I just, you know, tried not to watch too close. But father surrounded by wealth. His family used to yell at him all the time. He reached into his cassock and he snuck something, which I assume to be money, into his hand. This was watching charity. He's surrounded by wealth, but he never, you know, kept gifts that his family gave him. One example I saw myself, not to mention, I don't know if you're familiar with Misericordia here in Illinois. I live in Indiana, but in Illinois, where Sister Rosemary takes in people who are developmentally, physically, you know, challenged. My mother was lucky with my dad to see the original Misericordia in Italy.
To your point, Denise, if I can jump in, you're making a very good point, and that is that the church, the Catholic Church, does profound and vast amounts of work for the poor that are unseen, and that's how they should be. You know, it shouldn't be for show or for glory. And a lot of people, they don't take that into account. An interesting thing, you mentioned the mega preachers or the mega church pastors. I've noticed that a lot of them will have a kind of pretense of having a little orphanage in Haiti or a little something like that, a little school that they've built. And so they use that as kind of a showcase. So look, we're spending a lot of money, but at the same time buying the Arabian stallions and the private jets and the mansions and things like that. So they do kind of have that beard to disguise what's going on. But I think most people can see through it. They can see what's going on.
I think so. And then the last comment I have to make is I have fourth grade religion students I teach, and I tell them, if you don't remember much that I'm teaching you, please always remember what would Jesus do. And I would like to say that, again, with respect to these mega people, do you think Jesus would have his own jet? He walked around. I don't know. I can't say that for sure. Maybe Jesus would use the jet. I don't know. But thank you so
much. I'm pretty sure he wouldn't. Oh, you're welcome,
know what?
Denise.
Me too. But you know how you want to always say, "Okay, maybe I'm I can't speak." But I just want to say that I love your program and thank you and God bless you.
Thank you. Very kind of you. I love your energy and a point you make is right on target. Thank you, Denise. I appreciate it. You know, I'm reminded based upon what Denise was saying about what Jesus had to say. He said in Luke chapter 9, Jesus said, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." So you see, here Jesus is referring to, as Denise alluded to, his own itinerant mission. He walked everywhere. I mean, yes, he was taken on the back of a colt into Jerusalem on the day of Palm Sunday, a week before his death on the cross. But short of that, we don't really see. And I'm trying to think if there are any mentions. I'd have to go back and do a word search. But typically, Jesus would walk everywhere. There would have been horses. There would have been chariots. There would have been carts and things of that nature. But instead, Jesus chose to walk everywhere. And I think that is a sign of his humility and also the sign of his poverty of spirit. He was poor, and he was poor by choice. Jesus could easily have lived in the finest of palaces. He had plenty of people following him. Thousands upon thousands of people, and they saw him perform miracles. He could have gone into business. He could have said, "All right, well, you know, here's a sliding scale of what it will cost you to have some disease cured, or if you want a friend raised from the dead, I can do all that stuff. I've already shown you I can do it. You're running low on food? No problem. I'll save you some money. I'll just multiply tons of bread and everything, and here's my sliding scale of prices to do that." If Jesus were anyone but Jesus, God himself, he could have done that. He would have lived in the finest palace, rivaling anything that King Herod could possibly have had. He would have had people doing his bidding left and right because they would have seen him as the superhuman figure that they could get something from. And yet what we see in the Gospels, the Jesus that you encounter in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John is anything but that. I'm certain, absolutely certain, Jesus would not have had a private jet because he would have had the equivalent of that in his day, and he didn't. He didn't. He was poor. And so maybe the television preachers ought to rethink their whole position on this because their opulence certainly does not emulate that of Jesus. Now, you may say, the clever person may say, "Oh, yeah, okay, well, what about the popes? The popes live in this palace, a very expensive piece of real estate in the center of Rome. Come on. I mean, that's high living, and that's true. But you'll notice that popes come and go. The apostolic palace doesn't belong to them. They're temporary occupants. Pope John Paul I, 33 days. Boom, done, out. That's it. He didn't own that. Pope Francis doesn't own that. I'm tempted to say, you didn't build that, but I'm not going to say that because it doesn't have any connection with this. But my point is simply that these are the works over many centuries of human beings seeking to glorify God. And were there popes at times who lived in opulence and were all about the money? Yes, there were. We can't deny those difficult chapters of the church's history. Were they any better or were they any holier than some of the mega preachers who have the jet airplanes and the Arabian stallions? No, some of the popes were even worse in some respects than these kooky health and wealth prosperity preachers. Some of the popes were even worse than they were. But they are the exception to the rule. They don't make the rule itself. So just remember that. Do we have some really opulent, beautiful, grand buildings? Yes, we do. And most of those tend to have been built, you know, many centuries ago, or at least a long time ago. And they were built by the people who wanted something beautiful for God. And they also wanted someplace beautiful where they could go and worship. However wealthy or poor they may be, they could all gather together under the single roof of the cathedral or the beautiful church, wherever it may have been, and they could worship God. And the beauty of those churches was intended to raise their minds and their hearts to God and to the things of God. If you're sitting in a bare bones, empty meeting room on a folding chair, will you be, humanly speaking, all other things being equal, will you be more or less inclined to raise your mind and your heart to God and the things of God than if you were, let's say, in one of these beautiful old cathedrals with soaring ceilings and stained glass windows and intricate artwork, all of those things that just lavish beauty on every square inch of the building? I mean, I think most people, I know there are some contrarians out there who would say, oh no, I'd be much better able to pray if I were in the empty box of a room sitting on a folding chair. Okay, there will always be people who will say that, but I don't think they're in the majority. I think the vast majority of human beings, because we are creatures of flesh and bone, we are embodied souls. We are souls and bodies united as a single unit in our humanity, and our senses influence and the things that our senses bring to us, to you, what your senses apprehend, what you see and touch and taste, etc. Those things, that sensory input that comes into you from your senses has an effect on your soul. It can't help but have an effect on your soul. So my point is simply that all of this beauty that you see in some of these churches, it's not because that archbishop owns it. He can't spend that. I mean, by the way, if somebody like that did do that, and we've seen some instances in recent years, they get in trouble because that does not rightly belong to the bishop or the archbishop or the pope himself, for that matter. It belongs to the people of God, and it's for that reason. And you and I should be grateful, I think, to the people who came before us, who were so generous and assiduous in their efforts, you know, giving their pennies and doing what they could to fund and build these beautiful parishes, these beautiful cathedrals, so that future generations like ours and those that will come after us will have a beautiful place to worship God. I think we owe them a great debt of gratitude, don't you? Let's take a break. We'll come back straight to your phone calls. The number is 888-914-9149. You can call now. We've got a line or two open. 888-914-9149. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
All right, let's go to Jerry in Naperville, Illinois. Welcome, Jerry.
Hi, Patrick. I was just commenting. I went to Europe and I saw some cathedrals, and the ones in Munich were just spectacular. And I, mm-hmm. you know, you really felt the presence of God. Then you go to some. I went to Geneva, and you know, there was a cathedral that was taken over by the Protestants. I went to Dublin, and there was another one that was taken over. And you could really see the difference. One becomes yes. dark and sterile, and you really felt the presence of God. So your comment on the senses is right on. And I remember watching a EW10 program where a Protestant minister did tour the cathedrals, and he became Catholic because of he just felt the presence. He just said, you know, mm-hmm. how do these people build this? The other comment I wanted to have is, have you comment on, I know in, I think it's the book of Samuel, but where David said, you know, what am I, you know, living, you know, I'm living here in this palace, here you right. have cedar, and then God told him, and then, you know, this magnificent temple came up. And just kind of wondering, you know, this whole thing that we're doing when we have these cathedrals, it is to bring glory to God, but you know, God doesn't need our praise, but it profits us for salvation. And I just kind of want to have your comments on all that.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, because King David was, he was lamenting the fact that he was living in relative comfort and opulence, and yet the ark was in a tent. And so he had a kind of a natural human desire to see the ark yeah. of the Lord housed in a more fitting place. Oh, it looks like we just lost him. I wonder what happened. So I'll proceed without you on the line. I know what you're referring to. And what God was saying there was, you know, ultimately you can't contain me. You can't, I'm not something you can put in a box. And a Catholic might say, well, wait a minute, how does that track with the tabernacle? Cause isn't that a box, and isn't Jesus in that? And that's true. He is. And in the sacrament of the Holy Eucharist, we're now talking about something far more real and far more transcendent than even the Ark of the Covenant in the Old Testament. As holy as that was, it contained within itself the Ten Commandments, the two stone tablets. It had some of the manna from the desert and some other artifacts, but that is simply a pale shadow, a foreshadowing even, of Christ himself, who is truly present in the Holy Eucharist. So we don't want to extrapolate too much from what God said to King David in that incident, but rather simply to say that it is good and fitting for us to show glory to God with beautiful things in the church, to beautify the church so that it redounds to his glory. And as the caller pointed out, not because God needs it. God doesn't need anything. There's nothing we can give God or do for God that he needs, because he is perfect in himself. But those things help us. And as creatures, we have a duty to glorify God. We have a duty to praise God and thank him for the goodness that he has toward us. It doesn't help him, but it helps us. And as part of God's plan of providence, when we do those things, it actually, by giving glory to God, we actually fulfill our humanity. Think about this for a second. I know that you may say, what? When you're driving along and you see some cows in a field doing their cow things, chewing their cud, staring vacantly into space, browsing among the grasses on the ground. And there's not a whole lot else that cows do, quite frankly, except for the part that leads to greenhouse gas emissions. Other than that, cows are just simply standing out there doing nothing. But you know what? That cow in the field doing what cows do is glorifying God, because he is fulfilling, well, she, I guess, technically speaking, right? That cow, she's fulfilling her cowness. God created her to be a cow, this lower animal, this dumb creature. And by dumb, I'm referring to unable to speak. This very simple, humble animal standing in the field, chewing its cud, staring vacantly into space, not thinking any thoughts, just sort of swishing her tail to keep the flies away. That cow is glorifying God because she is fulfilling her cowness, what God created her to be. So my point is simply this. When you, as a human being, through your artistic capabilities, through your talent of whatever type, when you fulfill your human nature, to its potential, or as close as you can get to its potential. We're all sort of dog paddling in that direction. You are glorifying God because you are fulfilling your mission to be fully human. Now, unlike the animals, unlike a cow, for example, you have a far higher calling from God than the cow does. The cow is glorifying God in her own way. I'm sure God is very pleased watching the cow swish her tail and keep the flies away, because that's what cows do. And when you know and love and serve God, when you know the truth and you seek to know the truth because God has given you an intellect with which you can do that, and you choose the good, you love the things that are good, then you are fulfilling your humanity. And just doing that alone is glorifying God. When a husband and wife enjoy the marital embrace that leads to the possibility of children, that glorifies God. In that act itself, it glorifies God, because God ordained this for human beings. And when human beings, when you and I, when we enter into our humanity and the things that humans are called to do by God, and we do them in a way that is right and appropriate, that glorifies God. So you can extend this in any different direction. And certainly it extends, if you ask me, in the direction of beautiful art. And I realize that not everybody has the same, you know, feeling about different kinds of art. I personally don't like modern art. I find it unsettling, and I find it, it sort of has the opposite effect on me. It's not soothing. It's unsettling to me. I typically don't like it, but I know people who love it, and that's okay. But the point here is that in the history of the church, beautiful buildings, the beautiful ornaments, the things that we have learned how to make and accomplish are there for the glory of God. And as I said earlier, it makes you a better person the more you enter into it. It makes you that much richer and more capable of seeing God in the things of God. I love this stuff. Let me tell you another story, as long as we've got a moment. And then we'll go to the phones. I was on a speaking tour in Germany some years ago, and I was going from one university to the next and one church to the next and speaking over the course of about a week. And I happened to be in Munich one day. And as I was walking along, actually, I think we were driving, and there was an American priest who happened to be with me in the car. And he pointed to the spire several blocks away, this beautiful, majestic spire of the cathedral in downtown Munich, the old part. And he said, "See that church right there?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Well, my father had an amazing experience with that church during World War II. I said, "Tell me the story." His father was the guy up in the, you know, the B-17 bomber that we would send at that time of the war to bomb the cities in France and Germany. His father was the guy way up front. He was the bombardier. And it was his job in that glass nose cone to look down through the sight. And when the time came and the plane was over the target, then he was the one who would release the bombs that would bomb the factory or whatever. That was his job. Now, he said his father was a dyed-in-the-wool Southern Baptist. In fact, didn't like the Catholic Church at all. And as a Southern Baptist, he's on this B-17 bomber crew, and he's flying on one of the missions that they flew, probably from England. And he said that his father was waiting to drop the bombs, and what happened was, as the plane was going along, getting closer to the target, suddenly his dad had told him that the clouds in the smoke parted, and he found himself looking straight down at this cathedral, this very cathedral that was only a few blocks away from where I was at the moment. And it had been ravaged by the bombings. It was in tatters. Huge parts of it were completely rubble. And as his father, the Southern Baptist, who was there to fight the enemy, was flying over this, he said he had a mystical experience. And the haunting beauty of this bombed out, ravaged, ancient cathedral, he said that he realized there's somebody there. There's somebody in that building. And he had this overwhelming feeling that the presence of God was there inside that building. Now, he didn't know anything about the Eucharist. He didn't know anything about tabernacles. He didn't know anything about anything. But in that mystical experience at 5,000 feet or however high up he was, he had this deep, overwhelming realization, God is present. Somebody, and that somebody is God, is present in that building. And the beauty of it haunted him. So much so that when he got back from his bombing run, they got back to their base in England, when he was done, you know, with the debrief or whatever, he went and he found a Catholic chaplain on base. And he told him what had happened. And he explained to him, I don't know what this was. I don't know why I'm even talking to you. I've never talked to a Catholic priest before, but I feel as though I need to ask you what happened. Why did I feel that way about that church? And so the priest began to explain to him the truth of Jesus and his real presence in the Holy Eucharist. And it may have been God's way of letting him know that Jesus is really there in the Holy Eucharist. Well, as you might imagine, the Southern Baptist U.S. bomber guy, he winds up taking instructions and he becomes a Catholic. And then when he gets back from the war, he settles down, he gets married, and he has a kid. And that kid is now a Catholic priest. And the Catholic priest and him serving the church and everything that goes with it, it all started with that momentary glimpse of profound beauty, this external mysterious beauty that the Catholic Church has. Sometimes the Catholic Church externally can look ugly, but sometimes things are piercingly beautiful. And for him, that was the moment that God was waiting for him to start the journey home to the Catholic Church. And so for me, that was a huge blessing. And also it was a great reminder to, you know, don't be bothered by the beautiful churches. Be grateful for them and see in them ways in which God can work in the human soul that are very mysterious but very powerful. Let's go to Yoli in Anaheim. Hello, Yoli.
Yes, I love listening to Relevant Radio. I learn a lot about the Bible and God. About 5 years ago, a priest told me not to think too much on negative things. Is causing fear or someone to worry, or is worrying a sin, like against God's will? And my second question, if you can please explain James 3.
Let's take the first one first, and we'll see how well we do. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 6, Yoli, he says, therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? And which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to his span of life? And why are you anxious about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow, and they neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed as one of these. That seems to me to be the very best answer to your question. Now, I know it's easier said than done. Hey, I've worried myself sick a few times, and I have a tendency to worry about things. You know, my wife has a tendency to say, don't worry about that. It's going to be okay. So we all, in our human frailty, we all have, to some extent, the tendency to worry. But ultimately, if we take to heart what Jesus is saying, there's no need to be worried. You know, the way St. Paul talks about it in Philippians chapter 4, he says, do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. I think that too, again, easier said than done, but it can be done. So those are my thoughts, Yoli. What do you think? Yoli? Maybe we lost Yoli. Oh, I'm sorry, Yoli. Well, we're too close to the break to be able to take another call, but we will be getting back to the phone calls here. Then hour three is about to start in just a minute. A quick little bit of news. Melinda French Gates, she's the one who's divorcing from Bill Gates, I guess you know, and Mackenzie Scott, formerly married to Jeff Bezos of Amazon fame, they've announced that they're pairing up to start a philanthropic outreach to give $40 million to advancing the power and influence of American women over the next decade. And this, as you might imagine, will take the form of, among other things, trying to empower women with abortion and contraception and such things. It will also be used, and maybe primarily so, for businesses, and they want to make sure that the women out there are funded to be able to rise higher. Now, my thought about this issue is, first of all, I hope that they define the word woman. So if they're going to empower women, I'd like to know how they define the term women. Is it the female of the species, the member of the species that can produce eggs and gestate young? Or is it open to anyone, including people, men, for example, who claim that they are now women? So I'd like to know what the definition is of woman for them. And also, if they define it more broadly, I wonder how they'll feel if a man decides to identify as a woman, if he can get some of that $40 million. That would be interesting, don't you think? I'll be right back with Hour 3 right after this.